You're listening to the Warden Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast, and I am your host, Alex Gromatsky, and today I'm going to be talking to Javelle Fernandez. She is a healthcare executive that has spent over 20 years in the healthcare industry and is now in the process of developing an oral cancer drug, which is currently in phase one. She's also going to be publishing a book at the end of January, which is going to share some of her insights from having lived in 5 different countries and having traveled across 50 different countries. So thank you for being on today, Javelle. We look forward to hearing your story.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alex. And of course, really looking forward to have this conversation with you. I truly also, I'm a big fan, especially after listening to your podcast, the journey that you've been through as well, changing from one industry to the other. It was truly remarkable. So yeah, I mean, I'm honored to be part of this podcast today.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and you've had a long career in healthcare and have taken on major projects. Are you open to sharing, some of those projects and some of those successes that you've had with those?
Sure. So, as you pointed out, I've been in the pharmaceutical industry for nearly 2 decades. If I count my academic and clinical practice, that's nearly 3 decades of my career, actually more than 3 decades, and have lived and worked in 5 countries and traveled in 50 of them. So I was able to gather a lot of experiences, navigated through complexities of living and working in various cultures, being an immigrant, being a foreigner, being a woman in the society, and also in the corporate world. Now, the big project that I had recently embarked on with a friend of mine who's also a professor, I'm also a visiting professor right now in Kobe University in Japan. I'm one of the founding members of a company that is currently developing an oral cancer vaccine to treat solid tumors. One of them is pancreatic, another is brain. There's a long list of tumors, in fact, more than 10 of them, that we hope will be able to give treatment to cancer patients out there. So we will be starting our phase one, or that is to determine its safety among humans next month. So it is truly exciting because this is an area that I'm passionate about. I'm a gynecologic oncologist and he's also an oncologist. So we hope we'll be able to provide at least a mechanism, an alternative. Well, most of these patients don't have much alternative in the treatment of their diseases. So fingers crossed, hope it will be a successful clinical trial development.
Yeah, of course. And this is, as you mentioned, something that people can take orally, and then I'm going to assume instead of doing chemo, or is it a supplement too? Or can you give some technical background there? Because I'm not too familiar in that world.
Yes, of course. So what I can share within the public domain is that it will be an add-on in our trial. The way we actually have it for our first phase is an add-on to an existing chemotherapeutic agent. And that current chemotherapeutic agent has a very low survival rate among patients. So 10 up to 20% the most. So we are hoping that in addition with our drug, it will provide better outcome among cancer patients. So that is the current one, but we are hoping that it will be taken as a single drug in the future as part of our development.
Yeah. And what made you look specifically into this? Was it something that you were specifically trying to solve for because you had expertise in it, or is it something that you maybe stumbled across because you hear about these stories where people invent things by accident when they're looking for something else?
More than 2 decades ago, if I can imagine myself in the operating room managing a cancer patient, and then once I open up and then I would really see, I have a gauge that it's advanced stage, it's so psychologically and emotionally draining. I can immediately empathize, not just to the patient, but to the family and also to the community where the patient belongs. I know how huge impactful it is for a patient who is diagnosed with a big C. So at that time, I said, wouldn't it be good if, you know, the dynamics of the conversation, I guess up to this day, is that, oh, you have cancer, you know, you have this 3 months to live. Oh, by the way, you will suffer tremendously because of the drugs that will be given to you. Oh, you will lose hair, you will just fade, you will vomit, and so on and so forth. You know, all those ones are feared upon by many patients, individuals, and their families. So what I was thinking during that time is, what if we can change the dynamics of that conversation and say, oh, you just have cancer, just take this drug, and that's it, right? Can you imagine how impactful would that be? Can you imagine how the patient's lifestyle, the value that he or she will bring to the society will be prolonged further because of that care? And again, I may be having a wishful thinking here, but I'm positive with the science that we are embarking into.
Well, it sounds really incredible, and you know, fingers crossed on that side of things, because, you know, I think many people and lots of money and funding has gone towards cancer research. So, you know, you'd think or you'd hope that eventually somebody figures out something, and it'd be great if somebody in the Wharton Alumni Network did, but it'd be great if anyone really did, but, you know, it makes it extra special on that side.
Exactly. As well.
So can you share a little bit about what goes into a phase one? Because I think there's three phases, but you have obviously more experience. So it'd be great if you shared a little bit about that.
Yeah. So before I start in that, I would like to say that there's always a place for anything new. So many biotech, so many pharma companies, are so many institutions, so many academia finding a quest for cancer. There's always a room for everyone. So I'm sure working collaboratively will certainly create a huge change. So going back to your question, phase one is where we determine whether the drug or vaccine or any asset in development is safe. And then we go to a small scale study, whether it's safe and effective, then a wider scale study. You have thousands of patients, but then again, it depends on the type of disease that you are treating. You can have only a few hundreds or even less than that if it is a rare disease, but at least a wider net to determine the impact of your drug, how safe it is, how effective it is in treating that disease that you are trying to treat or manage. So that's how it is. And obviously, with the long, tedious process of clinical trial development, ultimately, you have to file it, approved by the regulators for use among patients where you would receive that indication. And in many instances, you have phase four, which is after the product is authorized. And that is where you have to do continuously safety evaluation of your drug or vaccine or any asset whatsoever, because then you will see various circumstances among patients who will be taking the drug, whether they have additional comorbidity or other diseases, or whether they're taking other drugs. So those ones will be determined as you move along.
So how long would it take for something, if it went smooth, to go from phase one to phase three, and how much money does it take for funding? Because I'm assuming you get funding, and you said you took the venture capital program to me before, and what does all that look like, that pipeline?
So the good thing, let me just put it in our perspective right now, the drug that we are developing, we're very fortunate that our phase one development is fully funded by the Japanese government, which is very good. So
that's incredible. Congratulations.
Exactly. And that's really amazing, to your point. And the second part is something that we will certainly need venture capital or partnership with other pharma. Essentially, it would really cost a lot, because what I was hoping is, because of the fact that it tackles several cancers, I don't want to limit the development in just one country. I would go towards various countries, and I would like to have an access of the drug once it's in the market. So typically it would take 8 years. It would take, you can think of the magic eight years, $8 million. But then again, it really depends. It really depends how your approach would be like, what type of cancers you'll be treating, how many patients you'll be including in the study, and so on and so forth. Hopefully, because of the huge unmet need, we will be able to accelerate the development And hopefully with the right collaborators, whether venture capitalists, that's why I enrolled in that class at Wharton, or with, you know, we will be able to find the right partner, right collaborator, so that we can accelerate it, so that we can provide the drug to those who need it most earlier than it could have been if it will go through the normal process of development.
So again, I'm basing my understanding off of TV shows, so it could be completely false, but it'd be great if you could fill in some of those holes. So if it is somebody that's terminal, it's my understanding is they're probably allowed to use that drug sooner than later, because there's essentially they're gonna die regardless is my takeaway. So they might as well try something, and then they become part of that study group. And in your case, is there, like you said, is there 100 people in the study group, or because you said it's tackling so many, do you have to have like 1,000 people? And it's amazing, yeah. The Japanese government is behind the first phase, so that gives you a great push.
So the first phase, we only have 12 subjects. There are certain inclusion-exclusion criteria every time a clinical trial is actually initiated, because number one, we need to be very mindful that we conduct the study ethically, that you are fulfilling certain requirements so that you are not skewed, the result will not be skewed, but will really tackle what you want, what your primary objective would be like, your secondary objective, and if you have any exploratory endpoints. So for the phase one, we have included 12 patients for specific cancer, urothelial cancer. For the succeeding phases, we haven't released the information publicly yet, but certainly we are having our discussions that it will have a wider reach, not just in the types of cancer, but also geography. So we hope it will be able to be useful for accelerated filing and accelerated approval in many regulations in various countries.
Okay, so do you know our statistics on how many projects, vaccines, drugs go past phase one and then either, you know, don't have funding for phase two or don't pass phase two? Do you have insights into how that pharmaceutical industry looks from that?
Yeah, there are many studies. There are many, insights on that. It depends on the time point that you take, and it depends on whatever therapeutic area that is. In many instances, you can have, say, up to 60% that will not go to phase three, meaning they will not have ultimate approval, because along the way, either you have safety concerns, either you have issues with producing your product from a manufacturing perspective, or, you know, if you look at it from a bench to bedside, right? So all those ones that are created in a preclinical meaning not use among patients, that could be higher as well. So it could, again, it could go as high as 80% in certain instances, because that is one of the reasons why during the drug or any development of an asset that goes to the patient care, whether it is to prevent a disease or whether it is to treat a disease, it takes time because of the fact that certain circumstances need to be evaluated very well, so that whatever is available in the market, once it's approved, will really tackle the appropriate disease that the drug will be indicated for.
And in your opinion, like 8 years sounds a long time from a business perspective.
It is.
From a human perspective, what's your thoughts on, you know, an 8-year timeline to follow up and check on people and see what side effects are? What's your experience with that? Have you seen, you know, that in general things happen and the body adapts in the first years, or what's your take on that?
So there are a variety of phases and circumstances. So there is also what is called accelerated designation or orphan drug designation or various designation of drugs, depending on whatever disease that you're trying to cure. You can have accelerated filing even lesser than 8 years. You know, like it depends on the regulatory context, the country. Some could be as early as 3 years. Some could be as early as 2 years, perhaps, in very rare instances. But then with this individuals, again, it's part of your development. So if, for example, you would say, okay, all the patients that started even early on in phase one, we would like to continue to monitor them throughout the course of their disease. So that could be part of those clinical trial protocols as well. And it could be part of what we call extension study or long-term study, so we can really evaluate the use of the drug and its value in the process.
Okay, well, so once you're done phase one, when are we going to know that you're going to be seeking funds or whatever for phase two? How do we follow up and see what you're doing and see what the results are? Is there, like you said, some stuff is public, some stuff is not. Yeah. And how do we support you?
So essentially, we would like to have a readout and within the first couple of years, so say by 2024, early 2024, we should have an idea already. Scientifically, I don't see any safety concern from a science perspective. So there have been several earlier, you know, like communication, several people have been interested to be part of it. But for me as a physician, and my partner is also a physician, we would like that before we embark on a huge project, we want to make sure that the drug is safe first, safety first. We are more concerned on the value that the product would bring more than anything else. So once it's safe, we can see it's safe. Oh, you know, it's good. So we can have that partnership. So as early as early part, first half of next of 2024 will be a good timing. So again, the other part, I think that you asked me a while ago, Alex, in terms of what inspired me, right? So I mentioned the experience that I had with clinical practice. The other part of it is what I alluded to a while ago in terms of being fortunate enough to live and worked in, to having lived and worked in 5 countries and also traveled in 50 of them. So I was exposed to various conditions. I was exposed to various healthcare conditions. And I feel like I can do more. I feel like there is something out there that potentially, apart from working in pharma, apart from what I'm doing, maybe as a, you know, being part of the corporate world or, you know, doing my stuff at home or doing my clinical practice, I think I can do more. And actually the Wharton GMP program had been very helpful for me to really understand and determine what is my real value in this world. So that really helped me a lot.
Well, and you have an incredible education background. So from my understanding, you have a PhD, you were at Harvard Medical School, now, of course, at Wharton as well. Did some programs at INSID, Rotterdam School of Management. Like your education history is just ongoing. And given that you've, you know, lived in 5 countries and traveled to 50, like you said, you have the experience and seen, you know, what are conditions like. So when you speak about safety, you're speaking about safety as it relates to also how it's being administered in those different areas. And what they maybe have access to. So you really have a pretty comprehensive view, and you said you're a practicing physician as well. So you have multiple facets that you can really touch on and really anchor to and see what could actually practically work in the world, instead of just saying, hey, what works in theory on paper and then trying to, you know, get that drug approved. So that's really incredible.
Exactly. But, you know, one of the things that really, resonate to me the most is I'm originally from the Philippines. I grew up in the farm, and you know, I started from humble beginnings, and I had this opportunity being educated in various countries, being, you know, achieving the best possible highest education, which, by the way, you may be surprised, Alex, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer rather than a physician. You know, we can talk about that later on, but essentially that really opened my eyes on things that, you know, understanding what really matters most among individuals. Like, we could be happy living our lives, whether we want to become very, very rich, whether we want to become very, very rich in terms of money or rich with relationships or having a very good solid foundation with the family values, whatever that is. For me, it's really more on relating yourself and bringing out the real best version of yourself so that we can make a difference. So I know it's sort of a so over the top or wishful thinking again, but I believe, like yourself, you had started this multi-million dollar project, and where you are today, very much accomplished, not just with your business, professional life, but also with your family. I believe all of us can do the same. So if we can find that niche somewhere, I'm sure we'll be able to shine and do more. So, and leveraging that education along the way, right? So,
yeah, I think you've heard some of my personal stories in our Wharton WhatsApp group. So I totally hear you on what it means when it comes to importance of relationships and other things and what we value right now. So you said you were, I guess, you didn't say born in the Philippines, but you grew up in the Philippines or were born in the Philippines?
Yes, I was born in the Philippines. I grew up there. I was educated there. I was also educated in various countries, like to your point, had a lot of exec ed and business programs in Singapore, in the US, also in the UK, also in Netherlands. So all those ones, bringing them all together, make me, you know, a better person to make me who I am today. And at the same time, I guess for me, I'm a forever disciple of continuous learning. I have a restless discontent. I believe that I can be better. I can be better, keep on moving forward to be better than my best today. Because I know my best today may not be the best tomorrow. And if I equip myself continuously with all the tools that I get from all those exec ed programs or education or collaboration also with our network at Wharton Alumni, you know, I believe that I can learn more in the process. I can be better in the process too.
Yeah, it's all about those marginal improvements, and they can come in many different ways. And I know I've definitely focused on introflection and the personal development. I've obviously done a lot of intellectual development as well with continuous executive education, as you have. And then I've dove into my spiritual development as well over the last few years. So growing that facet of my life. So you said you were considering being a lawyer and then ended up in healthcare, though. How did that happen?
Well, I thought maybe that the world is full of injustices rather than sick people. So I had this notion that, maybe I can do more if I can help people who are victims of injustice or something. Rather than, you know, treating people, I thought it's so easy. Because when I grew up, I'm the eldest daughter. I have five younger siblings. And when they get hurt, I bring them to the clinic. I just watch what the nurse or doctor do. And then I would think, it's so easy. It's not difficult, right? So I thought medicine is that easy. I thought being a lawyer is more difficult because you have to understand data. You have to understand everything. But moving forward, I didn't have any regrets. I don't have any regrets. I guess one of my regrets that I can think of, you know, early on in my career, when I was very active in clinical practice, when I was, you know, moving my way towards the corporate ladder, is the fact that I spent more time with work rather than with my family. I actually mentioned that in my book, because as a woman, you know, you will have your commitments to your family, whether you're a wife or a mother, and at the same time, you have the demands of work. And in some instances, you may end up really looking at, okay, you did that, like, we're on vacation, but my mind is at work, or I'm talking to my son sharing while he is sharing his activities at school, but I'm in front of my laptop, you know? So it's the being present now is something that I learned the hard way, which I also included in my book. But it is something that is uniquely challenging. But I do believe that regardless of where we are, regardless of our gender, race, you know, age, we can do something and be something and be somebody to someone.
And what was your book called?
The title of the book is called The Expat. And it is about powerful life, you know, powerful life lessons from living, working, and traveling around the world. And actually, I shared stories there that are funny, I shared stories there that are truly remarkable and extraordinary, such that it was a journey and a lesson to be a better leader, to be a better person in the process. So experiences like, okay, what would you do, Alex, if you are in a situation whereby your cab, your taxi stopped and the window is open and suddenly a baby is thrown at your lap? What will you do in that situation? So that is something. Something that is funny is, you know, what will you do is if suddenly you're in a public place and a nude guy appears in front of you, right? What would you do? And then what if you are in your hotel room and then suddenly a guy wearing undershirt with a screwdriver is knocking at your door and would like to help you so that you can charge your cell phone, for example. So it's hard to connect the dots. I'm just providing teasers so that people, listeners, will eventually buy my book, because we do a lot of medical mission. My husband is also a physician, and all the profits in the sale of my book will be used towards our charity work. So that's what we would like to do. And essentially, so not just the fact people who will buy it will not only contribute to the cause, but also learn from something that I believe will help them navigate through understanding other cultures, other behaviors. What are the ones that may resonate among individuals based on where they're coming from, and how will they try to manage certain situations or norms or standards?
Wow, so you've had some incredible life experiences, but I gotta ask you, what did you do when you had a baby thrown on your lap in a cab? Because that is terrifying, and I don't know what country that was in. I don't know if the idea of the mom or father or person was, you know, maybe this person can take better care of my baby and give it a better life, but I have no idea. So please share, what was the background of that story?
So I will not say more. That's so that people will end up buying the book. But what I can say is, for some reason, I didn't blame the mother for doing that. So I didn't blame her. It actually gave me a huge life lesson to assess me as a mother myself.
Because what country was that in?
It was in India.
Okay. Yeah. So it was in India, and it was from a mother. It wasn't some kidnapping and somebody was trying to get the evidence. It was from a mother.
It was from a mother. I mean, India is one of the countries that I love to visit every time, because it's always full of enigma. It's always full of some things that you would never expect, and a lot of learning experiences from me there as well. Another country that I really dedicated a lot in my book is Japan. I lived, it's more than a dozen years in Japan. So essentially, I had a lot of experience, women in society. Like, I don't know if you've heard of the situation when there was like, what will you do if you are in a situation whereby a life is at stake? Will you follow the standard or will you save the life? So I think that happened when there was a sumo tournament in Japan before, and the mayor, who is a man who was doing the speech, actually collapsed, and a lot of women rushed to the dohyo or the sumo ring, and they were told to leave the ring, even though they were just trying to help the person who collapsed. So that is just a situation whereby, you know, there are certain standards, there are certain expectations, roles of women in society, that it's so hard for a foreigner or an immigrant or somebody new to the place to understand unless you get a certain context out of it, right? So I shared the experience of the baby thrown at me. Unless I really understand, one of the things that is critical, I think, in our life is we have this maybe unconscious bias, or we have certain expectations and we think that we know what the other person really needs. But I guess if we try to listen, then we will understand rather than assume what they need. So I'm saying that because I would say, you could say, Alex, that, okay, you are assuming you have this cancer drug. You are assuming that cancer patients need your drug. Well, it is an alternative. It is an alternative that I would know, based on the science itself, will really, truly be revolutionary because it's the first of its kind that will be orally delivered to the patient. So they don't need to go to the hospital. And again, building everything, you know, learning what I learned from Wharton, how do I ensure that it will achieve its fruition? Like the, you know, how do I decide what are the areas that I need to take into account? Fruition in terms of the science, but also in terms of the financial support or other resources that I need in order to accelerate its access to the patients. So again, that specific journey I included in my book, what I am involved in, you know, heavily. And I'm so passionate at teaching as well, because my both of my parents are educators. And, you know, I'm a visiting professor right now on technology and innovation in Japan as well. So that is the one that I would like to develop young talents to.
Well, that's incredible. It sounds like you're very mission and vision driven. So hopefully, you know, all those things continue to have an impact, as I'm sure they have. One question, as I'm putting together parts of your story, when it comes to this oral drug, are some of those components that you integrate, are they all chemical compounds? Or did you find things when you were in 50 different countries that you're like, wow, these are interesting things that I've stumbled across? Or were there lessons that you saw from just how other places used and interacted with medicines and drugs that you said, hey, if this works for this and this works for this, and then you kind of came up with your own conclusion of some maybe holistic or naturopathic components with some chemical compound? Are you able to share any of that, or is it all like?
I can't at this time. What I can say is there was a mechanism that was created with this drug to make sure that it's not we call the company ImmunoRock because it rocks the immune system. Basically utilizing the immune system, arming it with something to fight cancer. So that's how it is, if I can put it like that. So if you take it, then this drug will say, oh, that's cancer that needs to be killed. You know, like essentially that's how it is. So there's a unique mechanism for it to be delivered, whereby it's not really like creating a lot of side effects, presumably, right? Because of the unique mechanism. The study that was done in animals, the tumor really shrunk. We were so shocked because it really shrunk, and there was no side effects among them. So of course, one could argue those are in animals. That's why we're doing the human study. So again, for the government to trust us with their funding for the phase one, it's truly something that we were very enthused about. And at the same time, they have assessed it very well that it truly provides value to patient care moving forward.
Oh, incredible. Yeah, I was just trying to figure out, you know, how you come up with even a cancer drug at all. And I'm like, wow, with all my life experiences, you would have seen so many things. And
yeah, what I can say, Alex, is there's so many mechanisms. Actually, after PhD, I also did my postdoc, again, on molecular biology and oncology. So you could say, oh my God, you've been studying your whole life. Yes, I am. So there are so many mechanisms for the development of cancer, so many. And whatever drug it is, it targets one mechanism or a couple of mechanisms. Or if you take a drug with another, they will target 2, 3, 4 mechanisms. That's why I said a while ago, there's always a room for whatever product that is approved in the market, right? So with my travels, with my relocation, with living in various countries, I'm exposed with healthcare environment. I'm exposed with what are the ones that are available out there. That's why for me, my quest is to have this drug, once it's marketed, it will not just be available to countries that can afford, but to at least broadly, because we know that cancer doesn't select a person. Regardless of where you are living, you can be afflicted by it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and this is on topic, but off topic. What you mentioned injustice because of legal early, and I just have a philosophical question a little bit, is because me and my wife talk about this at times. you know, somebody gets hit by a bus, right? It's urgent care, and I've definitely always seen, you know, use cases for that and the importance of that, because that's, you know, some arguably an injustice of something you can't do about, or some emergency, you get shot in the shoulder from being a bystander or something like that. When it comes to these cancers, and I know, you know, some kids are born with cancers, what's your take on, you know, how much cancer is in this day and age caused by our way of living, i.e. making poor choices, and how much of it is still an injustice of, you know, it just happens to wrong people? And this is not to blame anyone that has ever had cancer, but I'm more looking at, like, statistically speaking, because you also mentioned this drug, it helps in supporting the immune system or rocking the immune system. And that's one thing I really believe in, is that our immune system is probably one of the most incredible scientific inventions ever. And our body is just so powerful. So if we can, you know, supplement and have our immune system do what it's supposed to do, that'll probably be one of the most incredible drugs to have it work instead of trying to destroy things within it. So I've kind of always been against the idea of chemo because it's the destruction of the immune system. And I was always a proponent of supporting your immune system. So it'd be great to have some of your thoughts around that.
Yeah, so there's always that genetic factor. Unfortunately, for example, if you think of breast cancer, you have a genetic predisposition to it. There are some that are there for kids. To your point, they were born with it. So it's so sad. When I was actively practicing in obstetrics, I can see it's again, you can never think of anything that kids will die at a certain age because they have a disease that they cannot survive beyond a certain age, right? So that's also very challenging, very emotional, you know, psychologically, it's hard to live with those. Unfortunately for cancer, you can say lifestyle could have a role in it, because there could be, you may have a gene that is sitting there that, depending on the environment you are exposed, then it becomes magnified, that it will become a tumor in the process, right? So, but of course, I'm not saying that it is the only thing. But you know what, Alex, I mentioned in my book my experience as a physician, I was diagnosed with something which was life-threatening, and I had to undergo a very life-threatening operation. I'm sharing this not to share to people that, not to tell people that, hey, you'll be okay even if you don't have the operation or you don't have the surgery, because I have so much, I'm a devout Catholic, I have so much faith, actually. And you know, I walked away from that operation. I told the surgeon, you're a surgeon, I'm a surgeon. For some reason, I feel I'm so uneasy with this one. Let us not proceed with the surgery. What are your thoughts? Of course, I have to sign all the against medical advice things. And people will learn more about it in my book again. Sorry, I keep on coming back to it. But going back to your question, I would say that if you would, maybe I would respond it with, how do I live my life right now?
Maybe that's a great response.
Yeah. So I'm a huge proponent of plant-based food. I stay away from dairy, so it's non-dairy for me. The gut microbiome, the bacteria in our gut, in our stomach, in our intestines, there are millions of them. And essentially, if you can keep on helping your good bacteria, they will kill the bad bacteria. So in a way, if you eat non-dairy food, plant-based, more of greens, less sugar, if you fructose and all those things, processed food, for example, because they really will develop more of this, what we call changes in your cells, then hopefully you will have a better lifestyle. I have seen patients who are really healthy, doing a lot of exercise, maybe maintaining a healthy lifestyle according to them, but actually they're eating like processed meat, or they're eating like a lot of red meat. So if I have an option, I'd go to seafood. If I have an option for eggs, I'll go to egg whites or pasture raised eggs. So it's really that choice that I have to do. And of course, I have to keep on walking. I have to keep on mobilizing as well in order to make sure that I actually do.
I'm grateful to hear you say that because my family is very much plant-based. So we also have our daughter stay away from gluten. We adopted the mindset a little bit late. So our 10-year-old or 11-year-old son in a few days, he definitely still has some of the gluten, and I still splurge on steaks with him. But otherwise, I feel like I can't get full. But we try to keep that to once a week. But most of the time, we're pretty plant-based, also staying away from dairy. So very good to hear that, you know, from someone like you, that that's a path that's probably a good way to go long-term for our health.
Yeah. Stay away from things that would promote your bad bacteria. I mean, that could be the principle, right? So help your good bacteria to fight the bad bacteria, because that's where you will really, you know, you will really get most benefit.
Yeah, no, makes a ton of sense. Well, I'm really grateful for you being on today. Thank you for, you know, giving us this time. And where can we find your book? Because I'm really interested in some of the stories and want to dive into it. Is it also available on audiobook, or do we have to read it?
So, Alex, so I'm actually in the process of finalizing the book cover design, formatting, and all those. So hopefully the launch will be 26th of January on Amazon. So it will be available there. It will be uploaded there. And for the individuals who will be purchasing it for the first week or so, they will have a huge discount. It will be available initially on ebook and paperbound versions. And later on, you know, it will be on audiobook. But for now, we would like to look at the response of the readers. I actually hired a book coach, and I actually went to school learning how to write a book, Alex, because I don't know how to do it.
And
one thing that I forgot to mention, you know, why I'm also writing this book is my dad, who passed away last year, unfortunately, indirectly due to COVID, it's really a storyteller. And he loves to share his experiences. And I would like to emulate what he started. He's a huge influence in my life. So that is something that was truly something that I cherish. And again, I emphasize also the fact that faith is important. You believe in something, family is important. You have to prioritize yourself. And also, I do believe that we have our mission in this world, and that is, you know, to bring value to others.
I totally hear you on that. And sometimes it's a big mission, like curing cancer. Sometimes for me, I just remind myself it's on raising good kids and being a good husband, and who knows what they all do.
You're in the right track.
Well, thank you again so much for your time. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot, Alex.